Welcome to The Breezy Breakfast. This week, talk turns to Halloween, featuring Susan Radcliffe with some frightening real-life local lore. Jay Walking walks us through some spooky Guelph streets and stories, and Bonnie Dirtnell talks about her latest book, Haunted Guelph. Today's host is Phil Ault, and this Breezy Breakfast was recorded on October the 26th, 2023.
Good morning and welcome to another Breezy Breakfast. Today is our Halloween episode, or our time for our telling of stories, and we have with us three great guests to regale us with tales of the past in Guelph, some of which are perhaps a little bit creepy, some of which are factual, and all of which will be entertaining. We have with us Susan Radcliffe, who will be appearing online. We have Jay Walking, who has who has really heightened the dress code around here, as many of you will see later on. And we have Bonnie Dirtnell with her brand new book, and I believe it, this is probably our first opportunity to hear about it publicly in Guelph, and we're looking forward to that. And so with that, I'd like to, as I said, welcome everyone to Breezy Breakfast and begin with a statement of acknowledgement from the City of Guelph. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land. The people who live here today and the generations to come, if our actions today can move us toward reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. This place we call Guelph has served as traditional lands and a place of refuge for many people over time, but more specifically, the Adirondack and the Haudenosaunee. The land is held as the treaty lands and territories the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. Guelph lies directly adjacent to the Haldimand Tract and is part of a long-established traditional hunting ground for the Six Nations of the Grand River. Many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people who have come from across Turtle Island call Guelph home, as do all of us here at Breezy Breakfast and the Breezy Breakfast CFRU and podcast shows. So thank you very much. I welcome everyone. I would please note that today is an entertaining event. However, I would be remiss if I didn't introduce a slight disclaimer to please note that all of the opinions that are expressed are those of the person expressing them. CFRU and Breezy Breakfast assumes no responsibilities for those opinions, but attempts to work with fact and tries to avoid as much as possible any bias that is controversial of a nature. And of course, that can't happen if we're going to have a dialogue. I know I am controversial every day. And with that, I would like to introduce everybody to our speakers. And it's a special show because it is Halloween, and I have to admit, it's my favorite holiday of the year. It's one that seems to get short shrift because all we seem to think about are kids and candy. But I've also got to say, what's wrong with kids and candy? I'm so glad I don't have to get people gifts. I'm so glad that I'm not cooking a turkey. And I'm so glad that I'm not shoveling snow right now. So Halloween for me might be the door between the worlds. But when I look at what those open doors brought in, today we have Brian Holstein back from the dead of the Middle East. And that surely has to be a Halloween event for us as well. So with that, I'm going to pass this over to our first storyteller or historian. Susan Radcliffe is with us and has been a longtime member of Breezy Breakfast, who has participated quite actively and with very strong opinions that are founded upon fact. And much of that comes to us because of her background as both an English teacher and a historian. And then we'll move to Jay Walking, and then we'll move to whom I consider, apologies to Susan and Jay, our marquee presenter, Bonnie Dirtnell, who is just releasing her book, and this is her first opportunity to publicly provide offerings from it. Susan, I'm looking forward to hearing what you can say to us about Guelph today.
I am talking to you from my sister's house out in the country near Castleton, Ontario. I'm not sure if you know where that is. It's about an hour east of Cobourg and about 20 minutes north of the Big Apple on the 401. So I'm out in the country. I hope everything works. So I'm going to start off perhaps on a different note than the others might use. And I thought that I would share with you some heritage horror stories. I'm not a fan of ghost stories. And so this is a slightly different take. And this is my favorite cartoon about the ghost being people who got lost trying to fold a fitted sheet. So let me just go through them up and start with this one. So some heritage horror stories, in my opinion, start out with this one. Some of you have read about this bell. This is the bell from the old city hall, what now the Provincial Offences Court. And without any knowledge or consultation or anything, this bell appeared in the courtyard of City Hall, a place where no one can visit it except city staff. And so Leon Caron is in the process of trying to do some work on this. We had envisioned it might be a 200th birthday project, but this is the bell that came from here. So this is the old city hall. And in from 1874 to 1965, the bell was up here and there was a clock. And that kind of regulated the lives of the people of Guelph. And so when it had to be taken down in 65 because the roof was rotted under it, it went into storage with the idea that sometime in the future it would be put out for the city, people of the city of Guelph. Well, it is put out for the staff of the city of Guelph, but not for anyone else. So that's my first heritage horror story. The second one is what's happening to our agricultural heritage. And these might look like somewhat haunted houses. This is the barn on Gordon Street. The one on the right is the barn on Gordon Street that belongs to Madame Holmes. And they were supposed to protect it. It is on the heritage register. And a wall has mysteriously fallen down. We say I have a problem with walls falling down mysteriously. Maybe the spirits of the future are knocking them down. But it's not, the Madame so far has ignored what's happening with this. The one on the left is the Matthews farmhouse, right adjacent to the reformatory. And oddly, it's been neglected all these years by the owner. And it's probably the oldest farmhouse in Guelph, one of the original farms that formed the reformatory. So is our agricultural heritage disappearing under development? And then another wall that really, you know, did this fall down by itself in the night? And so this one, of course, is on the reformatory grounds, and there's a fence around it now, as you can see. And maybe the ministry will fix it, maybe not. The city has a motion that they encourage the province to do something about it. These walls are unique in Canada because of the work that's done with them. One of them is the longest one in Canada. And so it's something that we should love as a wall in our little city. Or maybe a chimney. This chimney is on the reformatory grounds. You can see it's a tall chimney. And chimneys like this are rare. I believe there's only two or three left in Guelph. And they're the home of chimney swifts, which are an endangered species. So this isn't the movie The Birds that terrified me when I was younger. So this is a chimney that's made with a unique kind of brown round bricks. And what's going to happen to it? And this one really, really annoys me. I just took this from the city website. And this is what it said for this past August, the holiday in August, holiday of the first weekend of August. On the city website, it's not even called what it's named. In Guelph, the civic holiday is John Galt Day. And this year, there was nothing happening on behalf of the city. And even its name disappeared. So poor old John Galt is being wiped out. Even his spirit that formed our city has disappeared from our own city's website. So it's horrible when a ghost like that totally disappears. And this, you may have walked across this. I walk across it very frequently. This is the Gow Bridge on the Speed River. You can see that the wall is broken. I informed the city a year and a half ago that I noticed it. I took pictures like this, sent them in, and so far nothing has been done. And one of the stones has fallen off. So are we going to lose the whole side of the bridge? Was my question to them. So it may be a bridge to nowhere. And even our mayor may not be in the right spirit. This is what he said about one of the houses that came up to city council. He said, oh, just push it over. It's more important that we have housing than heritage. So in counter to that, I'd just like to show that picture of the old isolation hospital on Delhi Street that's now going to be turned into about, I forget the number, 30 units of supportive housing. So it is horrible when this kind of thing happens, this whole misunderstanding about the value of heritage in our community. So it's a horror. It's certainly that's a horror. But we may be facing even more horror in the future when we all get called NIMBYs with a dismissive kind of tone of voice. This picture is from the beaches in Toronto, and it's also happening all over the place, where we see these tiny houses that used to house all of our families. When I grew up in a little house of about 900 square feet, me and my three siblings and my parents. And that house at the average size of 900 to 1,200 square feet is disappearing because of monstrosities like this. And now the average size of houses is 2,500 square feet. So we're not NIMBYs if we care about heritage, if we care about our existing neighborhood, if we care about having little houses preserved and maybe affordable houses, if we care about what's happening to construction waste, if we care about embodied energy. When I wrote to the mayor about this, embodied energy in heritage buildings, he told me I had no research to back up that statement, which is entirely not true, and that all of these buildings were made of local materials. So as you ponder this coming Halloween, just remember the spirits of the people and the spirits of our buildings that are so important in our city. I didn't distort your day, Phil, by talking about that, but I thought I'd talk about some heritage horrors. Thanks, Tanya and Morgan.
There's nothing more frightening than reality, and thank you very much, Susan. I appreciate that. There would be no ghost stories if it was not for our heritage inventory. And Susan, I do have a couple of pointed questions. Before we do, I'm going to just get to a question that Sheila O'Reilly asked. Can you visit the bell? Yes, you can. It's not difficult to do, but I really, truly do appreciate Susan starting off with the bell. The bell was installed there with the best of intentions. Regrettably, it was not installed with thought for how the community might have access to the bell. And so we have a bit of a conundrum. It was rather of a challenge to have the bell put in there. It actually had to be craned in to the courtyard that is in the middle of City Hall. And that from a heritage perspective, what I think is important to note, that particular courtyard is actually the ice surface from the old Memorial Gardens. And if you go there, you will see the actual center ice being marked in Memorial by a blue dot with a puck on top of it. Of course, that ice surface is well-remembered, and that arena is well-remembered for such things as the Guelph Biltmore's Memorial Cup Championship, visit by Governor General George Vanier when thousands of students cheered when he said that the students in Guelph could have a day off. We were all very happy about that. And there were other events as well on an annual basis, including our annual Remembrance Day observations. Roller derbies have occurred there. Having said that, Susan, I've mentioned that the City Hall itself is a heritage site. And I really want to push a bit with you on some of the people that I've come across in the last week who were very critical of us saving barns. And they pointed out the barn that we just recently saved out in Clare Maltby, and credit to the people that believe that that was worth saving. Why, in your opinion, beyond NIMBYism, does heritage matter?
It matters because it makes our city unique. It makes every city unique. I don't know if you're probably familiar with the term, the geography of nowhere. And if you go to the corner of Clare Road and Gordon, you'll be in the middle of the geography of nowhere. Usually the banks on the corners, the restaurants, everything like that are the same. And you can go from here to Texas to some cities in England where the same corners exist. And places like Guelph, focus on Guelph, should have a corner that has something about our agricultural heritage. That's what shaped this city. That's why John Galt put it here. That's what he believed in. Our indigenous people came here to farm and to share their farm products. So places that are unique to a city need to be there to tell the story of the city for people who are newcomers and people who have been here a long time. When I do walking tours, I'm sure Jay experiences the same thing, and Bonnie. People say, I've never seen that before. I didn't know that story. Isn't that wonderful? So, and also heritage buildings are all built of local material. That barn would have been built of stones from that land, wood that was cut down from that land. And when you bring in new buildings, almost every element comes from overseas. So heritage buildings are also a contributor to climate change, to keeping the climate not destroyed by all the off gases and everything. And every time, every heritage building can be repaired and reused as something else. If you're interested in barns, I have a list of 100 different possible uses or uses that have been put into effect for barns. Think of it as vertical agriculture, for example. It could grow enough lettuce for the whole city of Guelph and keep the barn building there. So that's my answer, Phil.
And what a great answer that was. And with that, I just saw that Kim Wakeford had come up on the chat, but she had asked an earlier question. And I wonder, Kim, would you like to ask Susan your question yourself? I always think it's better if we keep it dynamic and nobody needs to hear my voice. Kim?
Thanks, Phil. And Susan, I wanted to thank you for your tireless promotion of Guelph. I think Guelph is very lucky to have to count you among its citizens. And my question was regarding that home on the reformatory lands. You mentioned that it was one of the oldest farmhouses in Guelph. And I just wondered if you had a date for when it was built.
With respect to Brian Skerrida, he can correct me. I think it's 1850. So it's before the founding of Guelph. And Mr. Matthews had one of the farms that was bought up in 1909, 1910, to make the reformatory. It's not quite on the reformatory grounds. It's classified as a different address. And it was used by for the Valeriot family, for example, Mrs. Valeriot was, and the family would watch out for what they called the go-boys, the ones who ran away. And so they were, and it was a beautiful cottage. Brian has found some lovely pictures of it, and it had a porch and a garden, and the boys at the reformatory kept up the garden for the families that were there. So Brian can correct that date, but I believe it's the 1850s.
Thank you very much, Susan. A couple of other points that I'm glad that you started off the way that you did. I just want to give a little bit of a heritage report that is a result of the efforts of Linda Busatil. Some of you might have seen that picture in Guelph today of Linda Busatil and of me sitting in a field on the west end of Guelph, a building known as the Mitchell Farm. And we sat there because Linda lamented that in the West End, there's very little heritage at all. And in fact, we seem to go to great lengths to knock some of it down. And she would, I think, actually agree with you on the Californication of design and the nowhereism of design. Almost sounds like a Beatles song. And she is very convinced that we need to have these heritage markers throughout the city, made as much as possible with those icons from whatever has deteriorated because of neglect or regrettably has been torn down. So what Linda did was talk with staff, and it looks like for the first time ever, Guelph is going to get an inventory of our heritage markers. And that ranges from everything from cornerstones to such buildings as the Mitchell Farm to what was discovered was a brass fire pole that apparently we didn't know we had. And we're now trying to figure out where should we put it. Should it go in a fire station? That's the kind of icon that that people want to see. And as it turns out, apparently Jay is researching that pole, and I don't want to know why. But kudos to Busatil for her efforts to make certain that we have an inventory. Some people have alleged that things have disappeared. There is some discussion whether that's in fact the case. We will know because we are going to have an annual report on the status of heritage icons in Guelph.
You know, 880 Victoria Road is called the Limestone Graveyard, so that fits in with our theme. And I've tried every single year to get the Limestone Graveyard on Doors Open Guelph because it has the Mitchell Farmhouse packaged up in plastic sitting there. As far as I know, I have a picture of it from when it was torn down. And also that Armel Corporation promised to build a monument or a cairn with a plaque on it to memorialize the Mitchell Farm. And that has never happened. So maybe, you know, Linda could get that included as well to follow up on those kinds of promises that were never kept by developers.
Yes, indeed. And she is, because that is not just a promise. That is an obligation under an OMB decision that they are to do that. So we wait with bated breath. It's been 20 years. But related to that, Brian Holstein also pointed out, and I think it's important to remember that, Susan, your stories were excellent, but you did not mention any of the ghosts from council past. And I think someone would believe that. Some would say that that's a horror story. I don't know. I think that those people served well, and we should see them not as ghosts, but perhaps as angels of wealth. With that, I'm going to pass the mic over to Jay, who was walking around in an incredibly good-looking cape and a bowler hat, who will regale us with his stories of Guelph. For those of you that don't know Jay, this is Jay Walking, who will walk you around downtown Guelph and elsewhere, and not just entertain you, but inform you about the history that exists within our town.
Hello and welcome. Actually, it's really interesting. I have a bunch of notes, and I was going to stick to the notes. But now that Susan Ratcliffe has started talking about heritage and things, my mind started going all over the map. First of all, I'm honored that I'm here with Susan Ratcliffe. The historic walking tours, Doors Open, are a real inspiration. And all of the work that she does for heritage is really quite fascinating and amazing. She was talking about the value of heritage. I look at it, because I work in theater, I look at it from a cultural tourism standpoint. When I wander through the streets of downtown Guelph storytelling, I'm using the limestone architecture as my set, as my backdrop, as my theater scene. And nothing transports somebody into the 19th century faster than the language of the 19th century and the limestone of Guelph. It is so vital. I mean, that idea of, you know, the nowhere land. Nobody wants to go to nowhere land. Nobody wants to see a roadhouse in theater in which you bring acts that come in and you can see them anywhere. No, what you want to do is you want to create your own stories, your own culture. You want to create what we call cultural tourism so that the theater company, the resident theater company of the River Run Center is telling our stories. And people from all over the world will come to Guelph to hear those stories because you can't hear them anywhere else. They don't travel from place to place. They're performed here where they happen. So let me tell you a little bit about Jaywalking Guelph. And I do three tours, Guelph Early Days, which is a tongue-in-cheek history of Guelph. We talk about the Guelph's first blushing bride. We talk about a baby contest. Can you imagine 50 acres of land given by the Canada Company to the couple that can produce the first child in the new settlement? Have fun, everybody. Way you go. So, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, who can resist a story like that? There's also a tornado that comes ripping through Guelph in 1829. And I call that Strickland Storm. And the writing is so fascinating. That's what really captures my attention, is listening to these long, long sentences that they used to write in the 19th century, as opposed to, do we call them tweets anymore? X's? I don't know what they're called. So as well as doing outdoor walking tours, I do indoor walking tours. In fact, I just completed a tour of The Unfortunate Man at the Guelph Library. And we do it with images and sound effects. So I create a multimedia theater presentation and really love doing these things. And for those of you who don't know, the story of The Unfortunate Man is William Harvey in 1889. And this is a tale of a man who murdered his family. And yet the residents of Guelph call him the Unfortunate Man. Let me give you a little sample of the Guelph Herald in 1889. They wrote the following. Never in Canada has there been an occurrence so full of pathetic and tragical interests. Never an affair in which the love of home and family so overpowered every other earthly consideration as that which has recently taken place in this city. The surprise throughout the city when news of Mr. Harvey's arrest for embezzlement became known. The terrible shock and gloom which followed the discovery of his triple murder. Search for the author of this awful deed, his arrest in Toronto while planning for his supposed fourth victim, and the terrible denouement which would have followed the utter breakdown, remorse, and despair of the unfortunate man. The whole circumstances of his whole life made a picture that appeals in sympathy to every individual having knowledge of the facts, which can never be erased from memory and never be recalled without the instant feeling of sadness and sympathy. So here's a man who murdered his wife, shot his children, and they're talking about sadness and sympathy. So go on the walking tour and find out what that's all about. The third one I do is called Scandalous Guelph. So these are tales of scandal. A lot of these are inspired actually by Bonnie Durtnell, who's sitting beside me here. When I first came to Guelph, I was going through the library and I came across a book, and I might butcher the title, Bonnie, but the little boy in me got really excited when I found a book in the bookshelf of the library called Bums, Booze, and Body Houses. And I went, I got to read that book. And in fact, not only did I read the book, I took one of Bonnie's story and put it to memory, the story of Elizabeth Ryan. You remember that one, Bonnie? It's a wonderful story. I don't tell that one anymore because it's really Bonnie's story. But, you know, she writes some fascinating stuff and really gripping things. So I've taken some of those ideas. And then I also Bonnie and I were talking several years ago about Dutch Lena. And, you know, so here's a courtesan who bursts into flames, if you can imagine, catches on fire. Not all that unusual, because in the United States, some 6,000 people in the late 1800s, women mostly, burst into flames.
how did this happen? The crinolines would catch on fire. There's gas lighting and candles, and the crinoline is a very, very large piece of airy fabric. If you get a spark on it, this thing will explode. And as I said, some 6,000 women died this way. Unbelievable. And so that's kind of what Scandalous Guelph is about, tales of bootlegging, courtesans, and various other things. Now, we're supposed to be talking about ghost stories. And, well, I don't know if I believe in ghosts. But if I did believe in ghosts, I'd want them to do something more than go and knock over the candlesticks on the table. I think if I met a ghost, I'd want that ghost to speak in iambic pentameter. I want that ghost to tell me something really powerful. Something like this. The serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown. I, that incestuous, that adulterate beast, with witchcraft of his wit, with traitorous gifts, oh, wicked wits and gifts that have the power so to seduce one to his shameful lust, the will of my most seeming virtuous queen. Oh, Hamlet, what a falling off was there from me, whose love was of that dignity that it went hand in hand even with the vow I made to her in marriage, and to decline upon a wretch whose natural gifts were poor to those of mine. But virtue, as it never will be moved, though lewdness courted in the shape of heaven, so lust, though to a radiant angel linked, will sate itself in a celestial bed and prey on garbage. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you met that ghost? Hold me, geez, yeah, that would be fantastic. So I really like those kinds of ghosts. And so you can see that my background is theater. I like bringing stories to life. I love the walking tours that the Guelph Arts Council does, the historic walking tours that have been going since 1977. And really incredible. They're done by volunteers. And these stories talk about the built architecture of Guelph. And really, the detail is astounding and amazing. But as I said, I'm a volunteer with the Guelph Arts Council, and I started doing these tours, and then I wanted to peer behind the doors. I wanted to find out about the people who lived inside the buildings. What are their stories? And I know I'm onto something because I was approached by the Alton Mill Arts Center this summer. It's a wonderful arts facility, and it's trying to inject some tourism back into the village of Alton, Ontario, and animate its heritage, animate its history. And so they got in touch with me and they said, Jay, would you be interested in doing Jay Walking Alton? And I'm having a wonderful time playing in their heritage sandbox, finding all kinds of wonderful stories about the fire that goes through there, the flood of Shaw's Creek, and it's just filled with wonderful, amazing stories. So look forward to that in 2024, the summer of 2024. And I'm going to end with something that really isn't about ghosts at all, but I had to figure out a way to make it about ghosts. So that's what I've done. You might have known some posters around town and seen them. I'm doing something called Lilt of Laughter, Trace of Tears. These are wonderful, moving Irish stories that will warm your soul. It's an hour-long one-man show. It started because I was inspired by the Guelph Guild of Storytellers. And we've got Brian Holstein sitting here in the audience today. And I would go and try out these stories written by Charlene Harold, an old family friend, these Irish tales. And the reaction that I got from the Guelph Guild of Storytellers inspired me to put it together as a one-hour, one-man show. I did this show for Theatre Collingwood at the Porchside Festival this summer, a wonderful festival that they started during COVID-19 when theatres were shut down. And so they brought theatre onto people's porches and they performed outside and people sat in the backyard and could still listen to stories. And so I did that show there this summer to wonderful sold out crowds. And so I'm bringing it to the Art Bar here in Guelph. The Art Bar is the new home of the Guelph Arts Council. talk about bringing local stories to life. They're wonderful at doing that. And the Local Arts Council has moved into the art bar. As they say, it's not a bar. We serve art. I think that's a wonderful phrase. And so I'm going to be doing Lilt of Laughter, Trace of Tears at the art bar. Now, how does that tie into ghosts? Well, Charlene has written two stories that fall into that show. One is called Tom Daly's Demise. And it's a story, these Irish gentlemen sitting around by the ocean talking about cremation. Young man, or not a young man, but a middle-aged man, Tom Daly, has died in America. And he's had himself burned to ashes and shoved into a jar, if you can imagine, and shipped over back to Ireland to be buried. And so they're wondering about this tradition of cremation, and they start coming up with all kinds of wonderful things, you know, like what size of jar would you use? And I can't imagine a man the size of Tom Daly being shoved into a jam jar size, you know, and things like that. So they're wonderful, wonderful stories. And then another one, which is called Haggerty's Wake. And Haggerty's Wake is about Dev Haggerty. And Dev Haggerty, oh, he's about 40 years old and he passes away. And of course, they're going to have a wake for him. And they go to the pub and they have a few drinks. And now it's time to go to the house and to do the wake and to watch the body through the night to make sure that everything's all right. And they talk about Dev Haggerty. And they talk about the fact that, well, you know, it wasn't so bad that he died at such a young age because he got everything done that he wanted to do in life. And then one lad pipes up and says, oh, but there's one thing that Dev never got around to doing. And so what they decide to do is take the body out of the coffin and go and do what Dev never got to do. And it's a wonderful tale. And, you know, the amazing thing about Charlene is she can take the topic of death and make you smile. So I hope you'll come and see Lilt of Laughter, Trace of Tears. All right, let's get into some really good ghost stories.
Thank you very much, Jay. That was incredibly entertaining. And I'd just like to point out that you actually led to me creating some questions on my napkin. For those of you that don't know how we do this, we are a rather informal group. As people are speaking, I write down some questions to ask people or to make some comments. And what came up was actually something from both you and Susan that I think is very important. I think we need to recollect that Guelph's heritage has been very much a part of Hollywood and part of television and movie production. If some of you recollect, just recently, Murdoch Mysteries has been filmed in Guelph, and we have seen the likes of Nick Cage here filming as well. Equally important, I would remind people that that decades ago, Agnes of God filmed here with Norm Jewison as the producer-director and starring Ms. Jane Fonda. Now, what's important about that is at that point, there was a restaurant downtown, the Blue Ribbon Delicatessen. And I remember one of the locals being assigned the job of getting Ms. Jane Fonda her lunch. And he fussed and fussed and fussed to get her the right deli sandwich. Guelph is, as you've said quite correctly, is somewhat world-renowned, goes far beyond John McRae and Edward Johnson and some of the naughty writers we had from the 19th century that I understood populated Guelph as well. I'd also like to thank you, Jay, for pointing out that long sentences were once... the way of writing, and I can say that in Guelph we have certainly had the best of times and the worst of times. Furthermore, there is a Guelph connection to the Alton Mill. Susan Ratcliffe points out that Jeremy Grant and his brother were the ones that revived that, and I'm happy to say Jeremy is still a Guelph resident, lives around the corner from me, and I've got to say, if you've not been to the Alton Mill and not taking a walk around Alton, it is well worth the walk as well. But now let's get to some of these questions. Jay, you talked about Charlene Harold and your one-person show. I was wondering if you'd just give us some of the more interesting details about Charlene.
Yes, I'm pleased to talk about Charlene. Charlene actually was a family friend, a longtime family friend. She worked for my father, Jim Wilson Interiors in Galt, Ontario.
My father wasn't really happy being a store manager. It was at the time when a man would start a business and then pass it on to his family. And so J.H. Wilson and son passed it on to Jim Wilson, and Jim Wilson was sort of saddled with having to continue this business. But he hired some fantastic staff, and one of the staff people was Charlene Harold. And then Charlene Harold met my mother, Betty Wilson, who had a big interest in live theater. And so Charlene and my mom would sit writing skits and little review numbers and things for Galt Little Theater. And I had no idea that Charlene had the talent or ability to write a book of such sensitive, wonderful Irish stories. When she sent me the book, I was working at the Gravenhurst Opera House at the time, and the book arrives in the mail, and I open it up and I start reading, and I'm immediately struck by the fact that these stories are actually monologues. These stories are meant to be acted. These stories are meant to be done out loud. The voices come shouting off the pages at you. And it was really quite inspiring. And then Charlene also sent me a story that she had written that didn't make it into the book. And this story is Francis O'Feline, a story about it. And it's the most wonderful, charming story. If anybody knows Gus the Theater Cat by T.S. Eliot, it's sort of like one of those stories. And she dedicated it to my children,
nice,
Aaron and Kaylee. So there we go. So Charlene is a family friend.
Thank you very much, Jay. And before I pass the mic over to Bonnie, just a couple of points. Jay's one-man show at the Art Bar. Previously, that was both the E-Bar and the Green Room. And I'd like to point out that prior to that, it was Lane Stationery in downtown Guelph. If you go to that particular building, just take a look at the relief that is built into the entranceway. It's absolutely brilliant, and it's atypical of Guelph because it's not limestone. It's tiny, but it's well worth the look because it's quite beautiful, and it's quite atypical, and therefore is somewhat intriguing to me as to why those roses would have been put in there, whether it was just design or whether there was historical significance. Similarly, I love the story of Tom Daly. It reminds me of the cremation of Sam McGee, and I'm hoping that maybe you or Susan or Bonnie could perhaps write some sort of a poem, perhaps a ballad to Tom Daly. And I also have to say, wouldn't it be interesting if Haggerty's wake was at the Albion? And wouldn't it be interesting if we finally get that place open, and rather than hold a wake, we hold a rebirth of a great Guelph institution? Legend has it that Al Capone stayed there, but I know that Bonnie can tell us that that's definitely not true. So with that, I'm going to pass the mic over to Bonnie.
My Haunted Guelph book. It's the first time a book has ever been written that has coalesced all the different stories of Guelph that I've heard or that I've seen on the net or that people have asked to me and told me about things, because somehow, if you've been known as the Bullring Witch, you get to hear these things on the automatically assumed part of your world. Anyways, Haunted Guelph is just being released. It's caused more of a stir than any of my other books have. I guess I'm the flavor of the month, which I guess is appropriate. I'm actually, after this, I have a pre-interview with CBC Radio in Kitchen. So that was kind of a surprise for the morning show, which had the Guelph connection with the lead singer of the Cramdons is doing the interview. So, and I've had another couple of interviews, so it's been a rather crazy week. I've also given a talk at the Guelph Public Library this evening, which I think last call that I had known about, there were a minimum of 51 people that were going to be attending. So they finally closed it off. So, so there have been various stories about wealth and two of the people that, or one institution, one person that Phil mentioned, a couple people that Jay mentioned are part of it. And of course, the Albion is on the cover. When I first got the book, the cover concept before the book was, the Albion was perfect. It's, you know, it's the tale that has been going on since about the 70s. I don't think previous to that. And he sent it to me. It was like pristine white. And I'm looking at it going, this is a book on haunted Guelph. So he just made appropriate arrangements. As far as I know, and from the research that's available, Al Capone never stayed in the Albion. Rocco Perry's a possibility. He did have several mistresses, but it's not really likely. If he stayed at the Albion, it would have been because of mistress, because he was a friend, an associate of Joseph Veroni, who was Rolf's first godfather, I would call him. So it's not very likely that Al Capone, there was and is still a woman that haunts the Albion. I've heard several stories about that, but I'm not going to tell you that. Go still, you're going to have to buy the book in order to find out the solution for that. But the Albion is not the most haunted place in Guelph. If you want to be haunted, you join one of Jumping or Creeping Jays, walking tours with Guelph Urbex. She does the correctional center in the evening, and she's also done Spring Mill, which used to be, you know, McRae's Woolen Mill, Woody Atts, Allen's Distillery, Woods, and you know, now is back to being a distillery again. And I do one of her tours for her, a couple of her tours. One is the Ward History. And the other one is Murder Street, which explores Alice Street and Ferguson and Morris Street. There are enough little ghosts wandering around in Guelph. Some of them I did houses. I recently heard of another one from our paralegal, actually. She's thinking about passing on the story to them. A couple on Howitt Street. I think probably every street, wherever somebody there's bound to be one. But I think for a tale, I'll go to the correctional center. I've heard this from two different security guards. One was passed on me from Guelph Urbex, and the other one was a friend of mine who worked there when it was actually an operational prison. It has to do with an elevator and the hospital wing. Now, there is an elevator that is just outside. There's always, when it was operational, there would be a security guard or correctional officer sitting there. And sometimes at night, and they would be sitting there 24 hours a day. Somebody would always be on guard. Now, the elevator was a rather peculiar one in that it seemed to come up by itself sometimes. Sometimes in the middle of the night, my friend would be sitting there and the elevator would come up. Doors would open and it would go down again. I even did that when the security that they hired when the correction center closed took over. And in his case, he had to investigate it because he was really puzzled. The electricity was turned off. There was no one else in the building, and so he went down with his flashlight to see. The elevator was down again at the bottom. Nobody was in sight. And he went back upstairs, and it had happened a few times. Now, during the time that was open, it did this as well. And my friend was sitting there one night, and she was watching, you know, keeping awake, which is very hard to do. In the correctional center, and the elevator came up, stopped, it opened. She felt really cold all of a sudden, and everything seemed to be in slow motion. And then the elevator went down. Her first response was to phone her friends and said, I'm awake, what are you doing? You know, like, what kind of joke are you playing on me? Because apparently, when, especially when new were sitting there in a particular seat and had fallen asleep, there was another security guard beyond that would phone, and downstairs or communicate downstairs. And they would open the elevator, put it in a dummy, and send it upstairs with a sign on it, something like, you know, wake up, stupid, or whatever. So she phoned, and everybody said, well, I'm in the John, or I'm out there. I can't do that. And so that happened a few times. And people might say, okay, you know, maybe there was a short circuit, maybe somebody's playing a joke. But there was a three-step process to get that elevator operating. You had to have a key, and only guards had the keys. And they would turn it a specific way, and then they would have to engage it, and then they would have to push the button to go up to the floor. And that elevator basically only went between two places, hospital and the morgue, which was in the base. So that's one of the stories that is needed in the book, the correctional center. There have been several others connected with it, as well, of course, with the Albion. There's one wonderful one to do with a house in which a couple had bought. It's downtown area. I never give names. I will give a street address, not the actual address. The only address I give is to the Harvey House. And that one's relatively safe because it was torn down years ago. But otherwise, I don't, and I really don't give names. One for the security guard, his initials, he said, use his initials, and he was, you know, SS, the correctional officer. So I asked him if he had a middle initial, because for you to be SS officer really doesn't sound very nice. And his was about the chapel on the grounds as well, where he said, security officers, you know, correctional officers had to go there every day to check it out when it was operational and when it wasn't. And they would go in and make sure the doors were locked, the windows were closed, and that everything was where it was should be. He went in. He went inside and found it wasn't. There were like books removed, the doors that were recorded as locked weren't, the windows would be open some. And he was just starting off doing this. So he assumed that was, you know, it was just a joke or something. So he went back and talked to others. And the other officers were saying, no, but that happened all the time. In fact, some of the officers, after they had gone in there, and this had happened once or twice or something more had happened, they would not go back in there again. They just made sure that they didn't do the shift. So there have been various stories with the correctional center. I could probably write an entire small booklet about it, especially more if I actually got to go in and wander with my friend Jay and Ralph Herbex. So I could probably almost any street in Guelph, because usually it's a matter of energy and association with how strong the energy is. Like hospitals, Homewood. Didn't get a lot of stories from Homewood until after I wrote the book, and I ran across a couple of them. Some people had told me, and I would like to have more, but apparently a lot of it would have taken place in Riversley, because Riversley has an older establishment. And not surprisingly, in the book, a lot of the tales have to do with tunnels and basements, because, you know, it's like the old story. You're always told in all the horror movies or whatever, do not go into the basement. And where does everybody go? Into the basement. But some of the basements of the hotels, like what used to be the Trashaterian, is Guelph Electric, and the Albion, and a few of the other bars seem to be well occupied here and there. And some of the stories that come out are like the tunnels of Guelph. Some of the tunnels are mythical. I do not really know whether there were two tunnels that were used by the disreputable owner of the Desert Inn after Contini sold it to somebody who was supposedly an American gangster with ties to Las Vegas, etc. Or, you know, whether they existed or not. There was supposedly one tunnel to the Imperial Tobacco in one tunnel to the cemetery. But there was actually a one tunnel for sure, and it ran between the ballroom at the Desert Inn and the actual hotel or motel. And there are a couple of stories associated with that. But the musicians did use it to take their equipment there quickly from the hotel to the ballroom. We know that. I've had that told by a couple of people. But apparently inside the ballroom was a very creepy place to be later on. And sometimes outside, after the hotel was torn down, people walking by would hear little glimpses or little snatches of various music from eras that were no longer existed. And that's understandable because the Desert Inn, before it was the Desert Inn, it was very popular for big bands that would come to Guelph and would play there. And I've known a couple of people whose parents would go out there every night. And it became that even in the 50s and the 60s. So some of my book looks, it talks about the ghosts, but it puts them in historical context as well, because people who come from other places to Guelph, they come here. And if they're looking at staying in a place where there are ghosts, they will often pick up a ghost book. A couple of friends of mine do that. Wherever they go, or Guelph Urbex's owner does that. They go into any city and stay in the most haunted place possible. And then they buy a book. And, you know, they go on guided tours. So there's quite a demand for that. And it's another aspect of Guelph tourism, which we find with Jays as well. So Haunted Guelph is just an extension of that. In fact, it was a combination of my guy who he said 2 years ago said, you should write a book about ghosts in Guelph. And I said, yeah, and I'll call it Haunted Guelph. But he says, well, no, you really should. But I was working on Guelph's labor history. I considered that more important at the time. But this was last year, and into this year was when I decided to work on it. And so, voila, here it is. So it's available at the bookshelf, and Double Rainbow Cafe is going to have some copies there, and I have them as well. And so I don't know if there's any questions about ghosts. I am not an expert on ghosts. No matter how many times you do ghost walks, ghost talks, ghost hunting, you are not, no one is an expert. The way I look at it is that if you were an individual and you become a ghost, well, you're still an individual. And there are so many different theories about why or if ghosts exist. And even if you don't believe in ghosts, and there are lots of people who don't, many people will still buy a ghost book because it's a ghost book.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. And just like with Jay and Susan, I do have some comments and some questions for you. First of all, Bonnie, with the utmost of respect, I do recall Bonnie being the bullring witch and dancing at Stones Nights in the 1970s and 1980s. Bonnie was an icon there. And Bonnie, hopefully after you and I are no longer in this mortal coil, that maybe we can haunt the bullring and dance the night away to Mick and Charlie and all the rest of the horde that made those nights interesting. I do have a couple of questions for you, and I'm going to ask one of them as two parts. First of all, could you, for people that don't understand who Rocco Perry is, and who I think is probably one of the most under-known villains in Canadian history, I think it's worthwhile talking about him, why he's important, and also, can you talk about what I think is another under-noted event, Guelph's largest funeral?
Rocco Perry. Now, Al Capone sounds glamorous, and it just goes back to we don't often look for local heroes or local villains or, Canadian villains. We go, well, there was Rocco Perry in Guelph, though. Why wasn't in Guelph? But he was connected to Joseph Veroni. Now, Rocco Perry was born in Italy. He came over, not really sure, but about 1911, he was staying in Guelph with Joseph Ferroni, and he had known Ferroni from Italy. Now, there's a major difference between Joseph Ferroni and Rocco Perry, not just the matter of fame and that Rocco Perry outlived Ferroni and wasn't knocked off like Ferroni was, but that Perry was, he was the whiskey king of Canada. The only person, well, it was more of an institution that smuggled more whiskey over the border than Perry was probably Seagram's, who was doing that a lot during the war. Not Sleeman's, Seagram's. Rocco Perry was just chump change originally. I think the connection with Ferroni inspired him. And after a rather unfortunate incident with Joseph Ferroni, in which one man, Fazzari, was shot in the back on Alice Street, ran down Morris and died on his front porch in Morris, on Morris Street. He moved back to Toronto after being detained by the police for a bit. And then he ran away with the woman who was in charge of the boarding house he was staying in. And her name was Bessie. Bessie was married at that time, had two children, had been assumed to be a good Jewish girl. She left her husband and two children and ran away with Rocco Perry to Hamilton. And from then on, Rocco Perry, who stylized himself as a spaghetti salesman, he went on to become one of the, you know, most successful bootleggers in Canada. He was partly due to his wife, Bessie. I was told a story that characterized the difference between, Rocco, why Rocco was very successful and maybe Ferroni wasn't. And when Ferroni came over from Italy, he carried all the grudges that his family would have had. If you were an enemy of Ferroni, of the Ferroni family in Italy, you know, even distantly, you were an enemy in Canada. He did not lay aside that. Rocco Perry was more of a businessman, probably with the help of Bessie. He looked at it. He had to work with blacks. He had to work with Northern Italians. He had to work with Southern Italians. He had to work with so-called Canadians and even had to work with Americans. So he had this whole group to work with. It didn't matter if Catholic, Protestant. He knew that if he was going to be successful, he had to do this. He had to put aside. Ferroni did not. Ferroni was also indiscriminate in some of his killings. There was an OPP officer that found him that he was not. Yeah. He never killed himself, but he had his own little cohort that would for him. And Ferroni, people would had gone missing from Guelph, and is often traced to Ferroni during this period. Now, as far as Rocco Perry goes, he continued to rise, but there's a story this woman told me. She was talking to her grandfather, and her grandfather told her that he had worked for Rocco Perry. And she went, "But Granddad, you know who Rocco Perry was?" And his answer was, "It was the 30s. We needed to make the money. And besides, Rocco Perry was a really nice guy. You know, we did work for him. We went inside his home. He made us spaghetti, and he made really good spaghetti." And then she said, well, what about Bessie? And he went, "We don't go anywhere inside or near when Bessie is there," because she was apparently not the very nicest of person, easy to get along with, but she was extremely smart. And when they tried to kill Rocco Perry, when they were going into their home, the first person, I think they say maybe it was an accident. I have a feeling it was meant to. The first person they shot in the garage area was Bessie. And they didn't get Perry. And Perry went on and he became involved in another with another woman who was also very smart. So Perry had brains, as well as business savvy. Was Veroni had married Maria, who was actually responsible for establishing, or was one of the women who pushed for Sacred Heart to become a parish. And if you want to know why there's also a confusion between Perry and Al Capone, is you get a picture of Perry and put it beside a picture of Al Capone. They're basically the same structure. And of course, they're wearing the same style of clothing from the time, including, you know, the hats and everything. So it's easy to see why there would be confusion. Am I saying Al Capone never visited Guelph? He might have traveled through Guelph, but Al Capone would have respected that this was, depending on the time, Veroni's territory or Rocco Perry's territory. He would have respected that. There would have been a meeting of some sort or an arrangement, because you did not step on the toes of another person of influence, unless, of course, you wanted to.
What about the largest funeral as well?
Well, Veroni's funeral was pretty big, but I'd heard rumors of one of the largest funerals in Guelph, but I never really got any facts about it. One of them was when I was actually was one of my first years in Guelph, and I was visiting Tyr Kathleen, and no, it was Idlewild. I'd been invited to a party at Idlewild, and this one professor was talking about there was a little old man on one of the streets in Guelph who was an older gentleman, and he was out playing in his garden in the front yard, and all of a sudden a car went by and blew him away. But it was a mistake. So he was given one of the biggest funerals in Guelph, sort of, too. And I've heard that, but I've never run across an article to do with it. Veroni's funeral was pretty, you know, everybody, that was everybody. But so were some for the Silvestro family. And in the case of the Silvestro family, there were, one case I was told, there were people on top of the Northern Rubber building watching and recording and seeing who came to attend to pay respects to the Silvestros.
Yep.
And then it happened at a school too, I think so.
Centennial Collegiate.
Because a woman told me about how when she was a kid there, and she just had to be told you can't go up to the schoolyard today, and there are people going by checking down and writing down numbers for the license plates, etc. So,
and that, for the most part, is haunted Guelph, except that I would remind people that Guelph had its share of fame and infamy. I think that we can reflect on the Albion as being a place where these bands appeared: the Sky Diggers, the Grievous Angels and Charlie Angus, and the Cowboy Junkies. All apparently appeared at the Albion. I know the Sky Diggers and Grievous Angels did. I believe the Junkies did as well, because I remember having a beer with Margot Timmons' brother, John, who was a reporter for the Mercury. And who could forget Neb Campbell, Guelph's own horror story, who was who made a fortune and made a career out of the screen movies in Hollywood. And she is our very direct connection to Hollywood and to movies. With that, I do want to thank our guests, but I do want to take a minute to do a plug for Jay and point out, and I'll take a picture of this and put it online as well, that Jay does do these tours and does do this acting, and he encourages you to please attend his shows. Similarly, Bonnie, I wish you all the best for the book. I hope that we hear about it for time to come, and that it becomes a frequently withdrawn book from the library as well. Thank you for keeping history alive, both of you, and the same with Susan, and for Susan's meticulous efforts to document these icons in Guelph that sometimes are missing. Then we have John over here who wants to make a comment.
The question is for you, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
Among the more innocent among us, we'd like to hear your thoughts on what is the fireman's brass pole going to be used for in the manor.
The manor is not up to today's building codes, and they need a way for the residents of the manor to get out. So apparently it will be installed just outside a window so people could slide down the pole and get out of there, because as we all know, the manor is Guelph's Holiday Inn. Now, with that, Tanya, I think you have a few announcements, and I'd like to pass the screen over to you.
Okay, so we have some council meetings happening in November. The Committee of the Whole, council planning and special budget meetings are happening in the first week of November. And in December, the last meeting of the year is on December 13th. So keep budgets in your mind. Please have your say on the College Avenue protected cycling lane. Share your input by November the 8th. The Downtown Heritage Conservation District study, there is a survey and it is live. It is online right now. And Clive Creek Watershed, there's a study has been done, and please send in your questions and comments by November the 10th. Now, next week on Breezy Breakfast is another mystery, so stay tuned. Coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be discussing the Baker District, the budget, Movember, and food security. So I wish everybody a happy Halloween. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you all. See you next week.
Thank you, Tanya.
And that is it for today's show. Music by Jules Germ, post-production by Scotty Hertz. Breezy Breakfast, fear not, as the breakfast will return next week. See you then.